Good morning. Thank you for coming today. We are here to hear argument in the case of State of Indiana, the appellant versus Tyson Timms. Representing the State of Indiana, we have Justin Robol and Andrew Kobe. And representing Mr. Timms, we have David Stone. Thank you, Mr. Stone, for coming today. Are the parties ready to proceed?
Yes,
sir. Transfer has been granted, so the appellant, State of Indiana, argues first.
May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for my rebuttal. The Indiana Code specifically authorizes the forfeiture of vehicles that are used in drug dealing. That is what occurred here. Mr. Timms challenges that the forfeiture law as applied to him, in this case, violates the Eighth Amendment, its excessive fines clause.
I'm sorry, finish your sentence, I apologize.
That question is reviewed by this court de novo.
Is it the state's position that there is essentially no limitation on the amount of forfeiture? What if any limitations would you articulate that the state would be willing to advocate exist?
Well, the limitation is set by the United States Supreme Court in Bajakajian, and it's grossly disproportionate is the standard, that the punitive nature of the forfeiture cannot be grossly disproportionate to the gravity of the crime. And Bajakajian,
and you're fine with that? The state is not advocating for anything any different than that, is that?
Well, that's set by the United States Supreme Court, so I think that's binding upon everyone.
So why is this not grossly disproportionate?
Well, I think if we look at the factors that the Supreme Court looked at in Bajakajian, it's pretty clear that it's not here, because we look at the essence of the crime and its relationship to other criminal activity as the first, then whether defendant fit into the category of the persons for whom the forfeiture law is aimed, the maximum sentence and fine that could be imposed, and the nature of the harm caused by the defendant. I think if we look at those four factors that were important to the U.S. Supreme Court in Bajakajian, it shows that here we have a very serious crime. We have other criminal activity, because he admitted that he was using this vehicle on a sometimes daily basis to drive across the state of Indiana and bring more heroin.
Excuse me, you lay that out as the factors that the court looked at. As I read that opinion, the court really struggled. They struggled with trying to figure it out, and the factors you lay out happen to have been the factors in that case. Not that they were lifting that up. As I read it, it says, they said, we adopt the standard of grossly disproportionate articulated in our cruel and unusual punishment clause. In applying this standard, the district court in the first instance and the court of appeals reviewing the proportionality determined must compare the amount of the forfeiture to the gravity of the offense. If the amount of the forfeiture is grossly disproportional to the gravity of the offense, it's unconstitutional. That's the standard. And so they didn't, with all due respect, what you're laying out for us are the facts in that case, not what they said they're going to rely on. So they really didn't give us a lot to go with. It's kind of, if you know it, you know it when you see it, it's sort of the standard they gave us. Grossly disproportional, the end. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I agree, Your Honor, and some of the circuits have gone and I think rely too heavily on the facts of that case, the strange circumstances you have with financial dealings under federal law of taking money out of the country, or a lot of cases also deal with the structuring laws of taking out more than $10,000 in cash from an account. And sometimes those facts do not apply as well to other cases. And I think the Seventh Circuit is, like in Malawica, treats those as factors, and that probably does go too far, as Your Honor recognizes. It's more, you look at the circumstances of the crime, the gravity of the crime, and those are the types of things that can be useful.
Would you concede that it was disproportional?
Yeah, there was some disproportional here, but it's not grossly disproportional. And I'm not even sure, I wouldn't even concede that, Your Honor, because we're dealing with
You're not conceding that it was disproportional?
We're dealing with a Class B felony. If anything, it was probably much less, because a Class B felony, we're talking a sentence of 6 to 20 years is what he faced. Now, certainly he received somewhat what you could describe as a sweetheart sentence, where he only served 1 year of home detention and 5 years of probation. But the Indiana legislature has chosen to treat drug dealers very harshly. It's a very serious offense.
Counsel, I want to focus in on that. The Court of Appeals seems to have pegged as the benchmark here for disproportionality the amount of fine that's allowable for felonies in Indiana. But isn't it the same across the board, regardless of level of offense? And if so, what's your opinion about using that as a benchmark?
Well, I think it's a terrible benchmark because there is no proportionality. And I think that's a difference between the federal case law and what we should be doing here in Indiana. And it is important to note that this court has never addressed Baja Kajian in that standard dealing with forfeiture. But under federal law, there's a flat fine on all felonies of $250,000. So it doesn't really come up. But then they also have the sentencing guidelines, which I'm sure Your Honor's very familiar with more than I am. And they have proportionality built into them. So that it is a better guide, I think.
Speaking of federal law, what's the state's position with regard to incorporation of this Eighth Amendment right via the 14th Amendment? Is that settled law?
Well, it's not settled law. We've chosen not to really pursue that in this case, other than mentioning it in our brief of appellant. But in fact, even earlier this week, the Seventh Circuit again mentioned in a case involving a texting while driving fine that it's not settled law. And the Supreme Court made that very clear a couple years ago in the case out of Chicago that I'm not... I think the interesting question that is the standard for incorporation is Duncan versus Louisiana, the 1968 case dealing with incorporation of a right to jury trial. And there the court held that what we look at is whether or not a right is enshrined into our legal system. And it's, I think, difficult to say that the excessive fine clause is enshrined in that manner when it was never mentioned by the United States Supreme Court till 1989. So I think it's an interesting question, but I don't think it matters here, because if we proceed as if it does apply in this case, I think it's very clear this was not grossly disproportionate.
We have two sales here totaling about $535 and essentially a forfeiture fine of an excess of $41,000. Is there any, what's the factor of the amount of the sale of the drugs or the narcotic as far as the analysis of grossly disproportionate or not? What's your assessment of that?
Well, I don't think the Indiana statutes dealing with drug dealing really look at the amount of money involved. They look at the weight of the drugs, and we've treating dealing drugs under our prior scheme as a very serious B felony. You know, selling that amount of drugs could have led to a 20-year prison sentence.
And so, counsel, if I'm hearing you right, your argument is that the fine, the $10,000 limit on the fine, is not the benchmark. So when you're dealing with proportionality, in your argument, you're saying that the forfeiture is not disproportionate to the crime of dealing heroin.
Right, and that's what the Baja Kajian standard is, the gravity of the crime. And it doesn't say to focus on the fine. That's one of the many things they look at. They look at the sentence. They look at the fine as part of it. I think even if you did look at the fine here, you'd only be dealing with a factor of 3 or 4, and there are plenty of cases that have found that even a factor of 3 or 4 is not grossly disproportionate.
What dollar amount here do you think would be grossly disproportionate?
I think when you maybe get outside of the realm of what a reasonable car would cost.
Give me a dollar amount.
Maybe $100,000, where it's not what the legislature would be thinking of when they said in the statute a car would be forfeited if you commit this act.
The trial court judge seems to have a well-reasoned order. He considered other factors. So, I mean, you're kind of focusing on what the Court of Appeals did, but he looked at the fact that he had driven the car from, it was mainly between Marion, Indiana, and Richmond, correct?
Right.
All right. So he considered that. He looked at everything, and in his opinion, it was grossly, not just based on the one charge, not just based on the fine, he considered it grossly unconstitutional and grossly disproportionate. What did the trial court judge not do in its order that you think he should have done for this to withstand de novo constitutional scrutiny?
Well, I don't think he really considered the other acts because he focused on what was charged.
He made a finding that he'd driven his car, I mean, in 3 or 4 months' time, Marion to Richmond's about 60 miles. He had put $17,000. He testified that other than a trip to Ohio to see some family, most of his time was driving back and forth, and a lot of that was to feed his heroin addiction, correct?
Right. He
so
made
judge
this
had that.
He did make those factual findings, but I think his legal finding was based on the one criminal act.
So there's nothing wrong with this fact. There's nothing wrong with he didn't abuse his discretion with regard to any of his factual findings.
No, and the legal question is reviewed de novo. I think there was some error.
So what is missing? If the legal question is grossly disproportionate, and he makes factual findings that weigh into that legal finding, where's the error? You just don't like how he weighed those out to determine the grossly disproportionate.
Well, and his unwillingness to consider the other crimes, the repeated use in under Indiana forfeiture
law. But it wasn't an unwillingness.
Law.
He talked about it. He alluded to it. In his factual findings.
But if he's not willing to give that weight in his analysis, you know, just the fact that he acknowledges that that fact existed doesn't mean that he considers that an important part of the gravity of the crime, where Bajikagian says that the related criminal conduct is an important thing to look at.
Counsel, regarding your point on the limits of proportionality, and following up on the Chief Justice's question, if all other things being equal in this case, you seem to have just said that $100,000 would be disproportionate. So do I take from that that it would be unconstitutional to take his Bentley if he was using that, but not his Range Rover?
Well, I think that might be fair. I think it's important to remember here that we're dealing with a used car with 17,000 miles on it. When it was new, it was worth $40,000, which is a pretty average price for a sports utility vehicle. We're not dealing with something that is out of the ordinary that the legislature would have not been thinking of when they said that if you commit this act.
But if he was driving a $100,000 Bentley and using it to sell heroin, the statute would clearly allow the state to seize that, but you seem to have conceded that under those circumstances, that would be unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment.
Well, I think if you had all the other factors in this case, it might be, where the purchase of the car had nothing to do with the criminal act. But it's important to remember that Bajikagian has its limits. It's only dealing with the punitive nature of the forfeiture. There are other factors that the legislature are addressing through forfeiture, including remedial. For example, if the $100,000 Bentley had been bought with drug proceeds, that would be outside Bajikagian. You look at deterrent, you have the fact that someone is risking their $100,000 car when they're driving it to commit these drug offenses.
Of course, in Bajikagian, if I recall, there was no underlying crime in that case, right? I mean, he took cash out of the country, but there was no allegation that that cash was obtained through nefarious purposes. He was taking it to pay a debt, and he committed a reporting offense. Is that
correct?
Right?
So that was the crime. But, yeah, there was no other. The crime is aimed at drug dealers. It's aimed at people illegally moving money around. But here, yes, it was to pay a debt, and he was afraid of both the U.S. government and the Syrian government because he was part of a minority sect in Syria.
What guidance can we really take from that case in guiding our decision today?
I think it's important that in Bajikagian, they looked at whether or not he was in the class of people that the law was aimed at, and they found that he wasn't. Whereas Mr. Timms was dealing drugs. He might not be the worst offender one could imagine in that class, but he sold drugs on two occasions to an undercover police officer and a confidential informant. So he's clearly at what is being aimed at. So,
I'd like to go back, counsel, to your answer to Justice Mass's question. I guess I'm really surprised to hear that the state's position is that the value of the vehicle matters when the vehicle itself is used to transport the drugs that form the basis of the crime. Why should it matter if it's a Beater, a Bentley, or a Black Hawk helicopter that's being used to commit the crime? Why shouldn't that be fair game if it's used to transport these drugs?
Well, I think, as I was trying to say before that, I think it is fair game when you look at the other purposes of forfeiture, when you look at the deterrence and the remedial effects. But you can have a case like this where the vehicle, the relationship was just using it in the crime. The most of what is occurring here is punitive. It's also making the vehicle unavailable for him to commit future crimes. But I think the punitive side is stronger in this case than it would be in most cases where you imagine a sports car or a plane being used. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Stone.
May it please the court, as already been noted, Mr. Timms only made two drug sales, one for 2 grams, the other for just under 2 grams. Although drug dealing is a serious crime and a continuum of offenses, he would definitely fall at the lower end of the scale. As far as his trips to Richmond to purchase drugs, that wasn't raised in the complaint for forfeiture. The state did not see fit to raise that as a ground for the forfeiture until after it lost at the trial court. We think that's a case of too little and too late. In this case, no fine was imposed. In the Badgerian case, in footnote 14, the Supreme Court said it was proper to consider what the actual fine that was imposed versus the potential fine. In this case, the trial court found it was not necessary to impose any fine upon Mr. Timms. And the state knew about the trips to Richmond when it entered the plea agreement calling for 1 year executed and 5 years suspended. It's a certain inconsistency for them to now try and claim he's public enemy number one. It's okay to forfeit his vehicle because of his trips to Richmond. Mr. Timms was a drug addict. He was buying the drugs in Richmond for his own use. I think it would be poor policy to punish a man for being a drug addict, which is considered to be an illness because of his going to buy the drugs. He went through rehab, and he's been on probation since then with no problems.
Sir, would you agree that in addition to the two confidential informant buys, he on occasion to help finance his purchase for his heroin addiction was making some other sales or maybe driving down to Columbus, Indiana, and that we'd have an entirely different analysis here?
If he was a repeat seller, it could be different, yes, if that was raised also in the forfeiture action.
Would it have made any difference if your client lived in Richmond and used the Land Rover to drive 20 miles or 10 miles in the same facts and circumstance of this case with a much shorter distance? Would it change the analysis at all?
Are we talking about only two sales or multiple sales?
Two sales.
I don't think that
five blocks away.
I don't think that would change anything. And as far as what constitutes gross proportionality, in the civil area, the legislature and allowing action for criminal activities, conversion such allows up to recovery up to 3 times the actual value of the property. And I think 3 times would be a useful measure of what's grossly disproportionate every forfeitures.
Do you agree that they could have, under the way the statute is written, they could have seized the car on forfeiture even if criminal charges had never been filed?
Under the statute at that time, yes. A conviction was not required.
So if a conviction was not required, let's say they could have seized it and never had the B felony charges filed and a conviction on that, correct?
Yes.
So why would the analysis be different that it was a B and they received no fine he received a light punishment or a light consequence after going through the criminal process?
I think you would still have to look at the potential punishment to have some measure of what they're considered the seriousness of the offense and what would be proportionate or disproportionate. It's no secret that forfeitures have become a cash cow for law enforcement. They should be limited, however, to going after the serious offenders. They should not be deciding who they're going to go against based on the basis of how many assets we can seize. It's not being possible to think of a situation where an informant could say, I can possibly make a buy from 2 people, one living in a by-the-week motel, the other one inherited a home from his parents, and the police tell him, go after the one that got the home so we can seize it if he makes a sale to you there, stores these drugs there.
Do you have any suggestions for us as far as criteria, in addition to what has been alluded to in the cases, as far as what should be considered, what's fair to be considered by the trial judge in weighing and trying to determine under the totality whether there's whether it's grossly disproportionate or not? Anything that you would offer, a priority or
I would think the first thing would be, is the property to be seized as a product of the criminal activity or is it acquired legitimately? Second thing would be, what is a potential fine or the actual fine in comparison to the value of the property being seized? If the trial court doesn't consider the defendant sufficiently culpable to justify any fine on him, it'd be hard-pressed to say that they didn't go turning around in a civil action, forfeiting a $40,000 vehicle would be appropriate.
So the judge needs to look at a level of culpability. You're saying the test should include a level of culpability?
I think how serious, hardcore the defendant is as versus a lot of drug sales versus just one drug sale or two drug sales.
So we would be engrafting that on this. I mean, we'd be changing the statute. And the statute may be up for changing down the hallway, correct? I mean, there are several bills, but that's sort of for them. What would be, there was a decision made, if you use your car to sell drugs, you run the risk of civil forfeiture.
Yes.
So you're saying that it would be a smaller pool of just the big-time dealers that would be able to have an expensive vehicle seized?
Not just big-time dealers, but repeat dealers, those who are doing it on a regular basis, not just
to feed their habit.
Yeah.
But counsel, your argument hasn't been that the statute wasn't complied with. Your argument is they followed the statute, but application of the statute on this record is unconstitutional.
And also that they changed their position when they filed the forfeiture. They only relied on one transaction. They didn't bring up the trips to Richmond until after they lost, and that they should be held to relying upon what they argued in the trial court, which was one act of drug dealing.
But why should that have any bearing on the constitutionality of what happened here? I mean,
it bears on the constitutionality, I believe, because now they're trying to say he faced $250,000 in fines, so therefore it's not grossly disproportionate to take his vehicle, when in reality he was only facing a maximum of $10,000 fine, which and no fine was in fact imposed. So we're looking at $40,000 forfeiture versus no punishment, so 40,000 times greater than it was actually imposed.
Seems to me that may be an argument for some kind of waiver or something, but I'm hard-pressed to understand why that has a bearing on whether there is a violation of the Eighth Amendment.
I think it's because the gross disproportionality has to be shown by what he could have been punished for and what he was actually punished for versus the value of whatever the government wants to take from him because of his actions.
Can elaborate on that last point, if you would, please, counsel. I guess it's not obvious to me why the amount of the statutory fine is relevant to the constitutional question. If the legislature says the maximum fine for or the maximum fine for this kind of a violation is $40,000, and they seize and forfeit a $40,000 vehicle, presumably under your worldview, there's no constitutional problem. Yet if it's only a $10,000 statutory fine and they take a $40,000 vehicle, then suddenly it's grossly excessive. It's not obvious to me why that result follows.
There is no bright line as to when the potential fine versus the value of the asset become grossly disproportionate.
Are you urging that we adopt a bright line? And if so, where should that line be drawn?
I would say three times the value of the asset versus the potential fine the person faced.
Where does that come from?
Applying the same rationale as legislature used on what you can recover as damages and for civil action for conversion of property, you can get up to three times the value. If three times the value is considered acceptable in a civil action, three times should be a threshold for a forfeiture action, since it is also considered civil. If there's no other questions, I...
Thank you, Mr. Stone. We appreciate you being here. Mr. Abel.
Why is not three times the value of the asset a go-by, given the ambiguity of the U.S. Supreme Court's position on all that?
Well, I think the fine is just one of the many things that the U.S. Supreme Court is saying we should look at and to figure out the gravity of the crime, and that's what we're supposed to focus on. And I think under the federal law, the fine is a better way to look at the level. Indiana, we have one fine for all felonies, be it murder, be it a very serious A felony drug offense, or a level 6 or a class D offense. So I don't think here it really shows us anything about the gravity of the offense.
But doesn't it at least give us insight as to what the General Assembly may believe to be the gravity of the offense for purposes of the dollar value that ought to be at stake?
Well, for a fine, but as far as...
But that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about a forfeiture and whether the amount of the forfeiture is constitutionally excessive under the Eighth Amendment.
Well, but we also have the legislature making a separate decision that if this certain property is used in a crime, that is also subject to forfeiture. And it's not to logic Aegean that we have to add in that kind of punitive analysis. I don't think there's anything to suggest that the legislature thought at the time that they decided they would be forfeited for these acts, that they ever thought we'd be comparing the two. And if you look at some of the other times vehicles or real property are forfeited, I think it's very clear. For example, we have statutes, and that same statute allows forfeiture of any vehicle used for the third time and for operating while intoxicated in 5 years, or even the third time for driving while suspended in 5 years. So there we have very minor offenses. But if you committed enough times in 5 years, our legislature has decided that your vehicle should be subject to forfeiture. And deference should be given to that legislative decision.
Have either you or has the Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court itself, given us any insight as to what the framers understood the excessive fines clause to mean or how it was to be applied, whether in this circumstance or analogous circumstances?
No, and as I mentioned earlier, there's very little case law in the excessive fines clause where the U.S. Supreme Court did not analyze it at all until 1989. We don't have these forfeiture cases until the three that came in the mid-1990s. We do know that most state constitutions, even at the time of the founders, had similar provisions, but we're not... Mr. Timms hasn't raised a claim under the state constitution here.
And therefore, given the paucity of research of Supreme Court case law on this issue, what are you asking us to infer from that, if anything?
Well, I think that in most cases there should be significant deference to the legislature. I think that you, at some point, we know from Bajrakajian and Austin that it does become punitive, and so we do need to look at the gravity of the offense, but I don't think there's any more that I can really read into that history.
So if it had been a $100,000 brand new SUV, you concede that that would have been, under the facts and circumstances of this case, that would have been grossly disproportional.
Well, I'm not conceding that. I'm just saying that at that point it becomes a question. You know, you get some value where it's no longer what the legislature probably was thinking of. And at that point, I think it becomes very punitive versus what may have been imagined. But
very punitive, grossly disproportional?
Depends on the offense. And here we have a very serious offense.
Under this offense?
I don't think it would be necessarily. I think it's where it becomes a question and where you have to look at the other reasons that we allow forfeiture in this state.
Counsel, in your view, does the Supreme Court's case law on the constitutionally excessive nature of punitive damages in the civil context bear a reasonable analogy that we ought to look to? They've been fairly clear in describing, for example, what ratios of punitive damages to compensatory damages are so excessive as to present a due process problem under the 14th Amendment. Is that useful case law that we ought to consider here?
I think it is useful case law, but again, we get back to the problem that the fine in Indiana shows so little about the gravity of the offense that I don't know if using that case law and comparing it to the $10,000 fine is useful. But it does show how non-exact the gross disproportionality analysis is, and that it can be very disproportionate and still not be grossly disproportionate. I'd also like to briefly address the point he made about whether and what was raised in the action for civil forfeiture here. And we did, in that complaint, just talk about the one act of dealing, but under the statute, that alone normally would entitle the state to forfeiture. It's only when he raised the Eighth Amendment claim that it was an excessive fine that then we go on to the Bajrakajian standard that says to look at the surrounding criminal conduct. So it matters for the Eighth Amendment analysis. It does not matter for the state's normal entitlement for forfeiture. If there are no further questions, the state asks that the forfeiture be granted. Thank you.
Thank you, Council. Council, we appreciate you coming today and presenting this issue. We will be discussing and issuing a communal order.
This court is ready.